I mean, I want to see a really cool project idea, but what I really want to see is how you think. You know, when you've got 9 months to report on a story, as any of you who've worked in journalism know, it's going to change. And often, you know, a great project idea falls apart, and that was the case with me, where I pitched an idea and then, you know, got the fellowship, and then suddenly Tim Egan was coming out with a book on the topic that I had proposed, and I needed to do something different, and it turned into something actually much better. So, you know, we're not asking you to come and pitch a project that you are then shackled to, and you absolutely have to do that, but we do want to see how you think and how you've researched this project, and, you know, what kind of ideas are you going to bring to the table. You know, and another thing that we're looking for, it's, you know, I joke with the fellows, but it's kind of true that, you know, when you apply for a fellowship program, you know, go and watch that first Lord of the Rings movie again. You know, we're kind of looking for a hobbit and an elf and a dwarf, and they're really hard to find. But we're looking for a lot of diversity. It's our little newsroom of five people. And so you're looking for diversity of experience. You're looking for people with really creative ideas. But we're also looking increasingly for diversity of mediums and diversity of techniques. So, you know, this year we have a public radio producer. We've got a freelance writer who works a lot for National Geographic. We've got a picture editor from the Washington Post. So we're really looking for people who, you know, are working in a variety of mediums. I would absolutely love to get a fellow who does motion graphics. You know, there's just a lot of cool things that we can support and that we have the resources to work with. We have a very nice new website that just went up. It's still changing, but you can find it at the centerforenvironmentaljournalism.com. I also have brochures for the fellowship I'm happy to hand out that are a little more dated than our website since they're on paper. So we also have graduate degree programs that are affiliated with the Center for Environmental Journalism. So you can come and get a graduate degree at the University of Colorado and have a certificate in environmental journalism that's associated with that. That's all changing quite a bit right now because we have this new college to work with, which is really a good thing. We're doing things a lot differently than the traditional journalism education now. So used to be you came in and you picked a track, so you were in broadcast or you were going to, you know, work in news writing or what have you. And we've kind of eliminated that particular track process. You can be working in all of these things, but you can be learning broadcast and graphics simultaneously. You know, you can work across various media, and we're really trying to have our doors a lot wider open so that people that come in with really creative ideas of the kind of education that they want to come out with, that we can really work with them to create a program that's going to, you know, best suit their needs or what their goals are. There's a variety of other ways to connect with the center if you happen to be coming to the university, but those are the two main ways. We have a research track that's affiliated with the Center for Environmental Journalism, so if you actually are, you know, wanting to come in and spend your career watching the demise of environmental journalism, there are people that are happy to work with you on that. I'm not one of them. I'm being an optimist. That covers most of most of what we do at the center and at CU, but feel free to track me down to ask any other questions or look us up through the website, send us emails.
Okay, so I haven't done that program yet, but it's on my bucket list. So go ahead. Go ahead, Lauren.
Hi, my name is Lauren Klinger. I work at the Poynter Institute. Can you just do a show of hands, raise your hand if you're familiar with Poynter. Oh, yay, that is heartwarming. So I am going to apologize in advance because I'm totally in love with Poynter. So if I start talking too fast or smiling too much, like it's all genuine, I promise. So for those of you who aren't familiar with the Poynter Institute, it's a nonprofit school for journalists. We have been around for 35 years, and we have a faculty of mostly former journalists and editors who work at the Institute and do in-person seminars. So Poynter started as a place where we did in-person training of journalists. Mostly working journalists already would come to the Institute, become part of a 18-person cohort, and they would spend a week at the Institute. which is amazing, right? Because newsrooms used to send journalists, pay money, actual, you know, training dollars to send journalists to Florida to learn stuff for a week. Now, most of us aren't in that position anymore, where we have a newsroom with a big training budget. So instead, Pointer offers different things now. So we've got News University, which is mostly where I work, and that's our online e-learning platform. NewsU has been around for 10 years or so, and it's free to register. It's free to create an account on NewsU, and then a lot of our courses are free or low cost. So to kind of bridge that gap between, okay, newsrooms aren't sending people anymore, or they don't have the budget, or they've laid so many people off that, you know, it's just not happening. So instead, we've got a lot of cool offerings. So I want to tell you just about a couple of those. Just to get the lingo down in case you're not familiar, we've got basically three types of training on NewsU. So one type is we have webinars. So most people have taken a webinar before. Ours are a little different than your typical super boring webinar. I like to think they're more interesting. But anyway, so we have webinars, which usually means a working journalist, editor, researcher, educator, somebody working in the field, or an industry expert sometimes, will come to the Institute, be in our studio, and teach a webinar. So you will learn from somebody in the field. Sometimes our faculty does webinars, but it's more often than not we have independent people come in to teach some topic to journalists. So webinars are one form of training. We also have self-directed courses, which are sort of like online textbooks that you work through at your own pace. There's all kinds of information in there, activities, and usually they take 3 to 4 hours to get through. You can come back to them at any time. We have some cool environmental ones. We have SEJ has funded some self-directed courses. So we have intro to covering climate change, intro to environmental reporting, and they get a little dated. So we need, you know, we're constantly in need of new information, and we're constantly trying to update our self-directed courses because, I mean, you guys know things don't stay the same. It's like having a paper brochure. You know, it's not as up to date as the website. But one of the cool things about NewsU is that we can update our self-directed courses frequently. So self-directed courses, webinars, and then we have online group seminars, which is sort of a hybrid model. Online group seminars typically run 4 weeks. They have a self-directed component where you'll learn stuff on your own time, or your own pace. You'll read things, do activities, do assignments. Then you have an instructor who is giving you feedback and guidance, and usually a once-a-week online lecture. So it's sort of a hybrid between an in-person seminar and then a webinar and a self-directed course. So typically those are the three types of training that we have on NewsU. One thing I wanted to mention that is that I've spoken with my fellow panelists about is we have a really cool program funded by the Knight Foundation that allows us to promote digital tools that Knight has funded, because that's their little mission, you know, for digital tools for journalists through NewsU. So we've got over, I think we have a baker's dozen now, I think we have 13, free tutorials on NewsU for digital tools that Knight has funded. So we've got Document Cloud, Overview, Videolicious, Tableau, Sponge, Miograph, Ziga, all these weird names of startups that you hear and you're like, I have no idea how to use that. I don't even know how to approach using that. But they're totally free. So the beauty of the tutorial is that, you know, you start watching the webinar and then you decide, oh, this really isn't my kind of, this isn't going to work for me. I'm not ever going to be able to do a interactive timeline like this one, or I have a better tool for that. Then you stop watching it and move on to a new one. So Knight's funded it, so they're completely free. We have new ones all the time. And that's just one way to, the best thing about NewsU is that you can keep up with your skills, add things to your resume, add things to your portfolio, promote your stories differently, tell your stories differently, experiment and play with stuff, and NewsU kind of lets you develop those skills. So I am happy to answer any questions about what Poynter can do or what NewsU can do. You know, Poynter's mission is to train journalists, and we want to get that information out however possible. So,
great. And I have used NewsU a lot, and the new video tools. And the nice thing about it is you get to the end of the webinar, and it says, okay, you don't have access to this, right? Well, here's a free link so you can go get some, you poor freelancers, you. That's nice.
I'd also point out that, you know, even in my classes and even things that we do at the university, I have students assigned to use some NewsU courses. They are allegedly doing it right now because they're going to be tested on this material next week. So it's, you know, it's a resource that gets drawn on in academic programs. You know, I'm sure IJNR folks use it. And one other thing that I wanted to point out is, at least from my point of view, I'm kind of representative of a number of options similar to what we offer at the University of Colorado. We've got Hillary Rosner here, who maybe can take a moment to talk about a new program that she's involved in starting up at Syracuse University that sounds like it's going to have some really incredible opportunities at it. So do you want to...
I've got one more
really
panelist
quickly?
On the phone.
Oh, okay.
Phone.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, so right. Why don't we do that?
Yeah, when we go to Q&A, we will. Lisa, are you still there?
I am. Hello, everyone. Can you hear me okay, just before I start?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm an investigative reporter for the Houston Chronicle, and I also have been a trainer and a mentor for different groups over the years, and often I am right there in the room with the people I'm teaching, but what I've done the last couple of times is I've worked as a trainer for the Knight Center for the Journalism in the Americas in massive open online courses, and I want to tell you a little bit about them because they're pretty interesting. You can take these classes no matter where you are, anywhere in the world. They're free, and they're interesting if you have especially limited time, limited travel budget, or say your best time to study is after your children are asleep, or you really want to network with people from Jordan and the Atacama Desert on issues you're interested in, but you really can't travel all those places all at the same time. But MOOCs are sort of like an endless buffet of offering. You can take MOOCs from universities, you can take MOOCs from nonprofits, and they're available on almost any topic you can imagine. The Tao Center for Digital Journalism just wrote a story recently about a MOOC that the European Center for Journalism has been offering that's really kind of groundbreaking. These are a little bit longer than webinars. They typically last, say, 4 weeks. Some of them last longer than that. But they allow you then to enroll in classes offered by anyone, no matter where they are. The Knight Center for Journalism in the Americas has been kind of a pioneer in U.S.-based nonprofit circles in doing MOOCs. They've had 12 since 2012, and all of them are free. The ones I taught recently attracted 5,000 participants from 100 different countries. They lasted 4 weeks. Each week was taught by a different teacher. They usually are offering topics like digital journalism, investigative journalism, how to use your cell phone to do reporting, but MOOCs are available on just about any topic. I have on the conference app a handout on what MOOCs are like that shows you some images, some screenshots from the teaching that I've done and the classes I've done that if you can follow along if you'd like. They're basically, like I said, an all-you-can-eat buffet, open 24/7, offering video, PowerPoint, online discussions, exercises. You kind of can put in as much as you want or as little as you want. There is homework. Sometimes it can seem sort of overwhelming, but it really is up to you how much or how little you put in. I found that these conversations that crop up in MOOCs are some of the most interesting part of teaching them. The discussions on any topic generated by anyone in the class can really just be on just about anything related to the topic, and you'll find students finding common ground, journalists finding common ground who are in China, who are in Iraq, people exchanging information and building networks that last beyond the classes. One of the classes I taught recently still has a Facebook community with 3,745 members. People are still posting questions, interacting with each other, posting stories. There has been some criticism of MOOCs because a lot of people sign up. They're free, just like, you know, a lot of other freebies. People sign up and they don't necessarily finish it, so there can be some high dropout rates. But I think the advantages of the MOOCs greatly outweigh the disadvantages, and I would suggest to you that if you're interested in one, try it. The quality of the class really just depends as much as any other class on the effort the teacher puts into it and the effort that you put into it as a student, and it's just great to me to be able to offer a class that I know that a journalist could take, no matter how little resources they're getting from their newspaper or their radio station, because everybody's got limited resources these days, and that allow people to participate without barriers of having to travel somewhere. And that's pretty much what I had to present. Please look at the presentation on the PDF, and I'd be welcome to take any questions on it.
Great. Thanks, Lisa. Okay, so, and I think it was great that she was able to come via cell phone. I know it's a little bit hard to hear maybe, but, you know, at least she didn't cancel completely. So, okay, and I know there's some people in the audience that might want to talk about some of their programs that are similar. So let me start with them. And I will say, with regard to MOOCs, there's everything out there, not just journalism. I've taken classes on thermodynamics just to kind of understand a little bit more about oil and fracking, and you know, maybe I didn't get very much out of it, but I got more out of it than if I hadn't taken it. There's classes on physics, geology, biology. Everything's out there. You just got to look for it, and that's kind of what I wanted to bring out in this panel. So,
hi, everybody. My name is Sunshine Menezes. I'm the executive director of the Metcalf Institute at the University of Rhode Island's Graduate School of Oceanography. I really applaud Lana for taking a MOOC on thermodynamics. That pretty much just blew my mind. What we do at Metcalf Institute, and I'm just going to stand here so I'm not turning around in 15 directions at once. We have a kind of a similar, of all the people up there, our model is most similar to Dave's and IJNR's, although we take it from a different perspective. So as part of a graduate school of oceanography, we're really focused on the science underlying environmental issues. We started out really focusing on marine topics, but we determined that our model was much more broadly applicable than that. So now we actually look at a lot of environmental topics. We've been doing a lot with climate change recently, and that's because of a project that we have funded right now. And of course, this is also a super hot topic. So in addition to a week-long science immersion workshop that is focused on global change and coastal ecosystems that we offer every June, we've been doing these programs, these 1 to 1.5 day seminars around the country. Jane attended one last year. These are really focusing on regional impacts of climate change. Sometimes we're doing them for specific reporters or journalists covering other beats. So this past spring we did one in D.C. on climate change issues related to business and politics. We also develop science backgrounders. We're actually just starting to do this again, so our resources page on our website admittedly is kind of a mess right now, but it will be really great in the next couple of years because we're trying to develop a lot more science backgrounders. And then we also record all of the presentations that are given at our program. So we have a YouTube channel, it's just Metcalf Institute, and there are just gobs and gobs of short videos there that you can watch from a lot of speakers from all over the country. Like Dave said, we also, and actually like Michael said too, we work really hard in all of our programs to mix up the group as much as possible, to have as much diversity in every regard as possible, because it really enriches the experience and the conversation for everybody. And I guess that's it. Thank you very much for the chance, Lana. Okay.
Sure. Do you want to talk about yours?
Yeah, just quickly, thanks. I'm Hillary Rosner, and I've been a freelance journalist for, 15 years or something. But starting in January, I'm going to Syracuse University's Newhouse School of Public Communications, which is one of the top journalism schools in the country and is now starting up a new program in science and sustainability reporting. So it certainly doesn't fall under any of the sort of low-cost stuff that we've been talking about here. But it is a really cool one-year graduate program. I mean, there's actually going to be an undergrad program starting up in a couple more years, too. But if you want to come and do, you can sort of work across different platforms. You can come in and with a focus on print or a focus on documentary film or focus on interactive, but really do all these other things and learn how to use drones for reporting and all this kind of cool stuff. But you can do all this with a focus on sustainability issues. So that program is starting up next year. And if you want more information, I don't have a ton because I am not starting until January and the program is still being built, but I'm happy to talk to you about it.
Okay, so the parts you've all been waiting for, you see we've got lots of people in the audience and, you know, you want to ask them that wonderful question, how do I get in, what's the secret? So who's got a question? Anyone? No questions? Okay, Stephanie.
My name is Stephanie, so I'm an energy reporter based out of Washington, D.C. I had a couple questions that came up. So for Jane, I didn't know if you could talk about how you go about matching mentors and mentees. Is it generally the programs that I've been a part of that are outside of SEJ, you generally have to be pretty proactive as a mentee to kind of say, you know, I want to be in radio or I want to be in TV, so please match me with so-and-so, or maybe even seek someone out that you would like to learn from and then kind of help the program organizers by, you know, facilitating the matching. So if you could talk a little bit about how that has been working. And then I had a question for...
Okay. Go ahead, Jane. Here you go. It went to sleep.
We make the matches based on input from the mentee. So that's why I said the most useful part to us of the application process is what do you want to get out of this program? That's not to diss the other parts of the application. We are interested in your background. We use geography. Geographic proximity is one criteria that we try to use in making matches. I think we are less devoted to that now than maybe previously because people can get in touch electronically so much more easily than at a certain point in time. But I said you can fill out an application in 5 to 10 minutes. If you take 20 minutes, you may get twice the value in your mentor because you will have given us a little more information about what you're looking for. I think needs is one sort of amorphous category. People say, you know, I'm just looking for help with da da da, whatever it is. We have some mentees that apply that have been in journalism for a long time, and they're just sort of feeling a slump and feeling like they need a refresher or something. And so, you know, we make a match just based on the areas in which they feel needy. I don't know if this is getting at your question.
Can you kind of address the, somebody asked me about, can you get a mentor if you need journalism 101? Or is that geared more toward Pointer?
Well, that she's asking if beginning journalists, I think that's what you're asking about, are eligible. And so often these beginning journalists are students, and we do have a two-tiered application process for students, and that's basically because a student may take a class in journalism and get all excited about it and apply to be for a mentor. We go to a fair amount of work. It's a fair amount of time to make a good match. And often our experience has been, and this is based on the evaluation process, sometimes the students have moved on by the time we make a match. It might take us a month to make a match or longer depending on the response of the mentor that we initially asked to take this mentee on. Sometimes it is simply a figment of our own workloads. Don and I are both working journalists, and maybe we're traveling, maybe we're on colossal deadline or whatever, so we defer the mentor process to fit our own schedules at times. But sometimes students have moved on by the time we make the match, and the mentor never even hears from them. So we ask students to fill out a second application, and that actually has weeded out people who are on the move, and this may or may be sort of a passing whim. But I think on occasion we have suggested that mentees go to Poynter, and Dawn, that might be something you want to talk about a little bit more. We have made that suggestion, and I think it's been fruitful, but I'll let Dawn address that.
Yeah, I'm Dawn Stover, and I volunteer to help run the mentor program with Jane. And this is probably a little bit of a selfish question that won't help people in the room, but we do get inquiries from people that we don't really feel are quite ready to have an SEJ mentor yet because they're at such an entry level. They're just thinking, I want to be an environmental journalism freelancer, and they really haven't gone to school or done an internship or had any of that kind of training. And of course, I would try to steer those people towards some of those options. There's some fabulous graduate programs out there and all kinds of great training, and we have referred them to Knight and Poynter, but it would be nice to have somewhere a good compiled list of all the resources out there, and if there is one, I would love to know about it because, you know, we're kind of trying to start our own list of Journalism 101 or frequently asked questions for people that are even below the level where they're ready to just jump into a course, but they just need some really basic information about what does this entail and you know, how do you even get started. So if you have any ideas about that, I would love to hear them.
Great, thanks. Tony? Oh, you want to answer it?
It's okay. Yeah, Journalists Resource is a really good place to go, and I can tweet out the link. That's an amazing resource. Also, Poynter has certificate programs. We've got writing certificate, social media certificates, editing certificate, multimedia certificate. It's not a certification, but it's a certificate program. So basically, the student would go through a handful of self-directed courses or webinars and then be assessed at the end. So there are quizzes, assessments based on the courses, then they've completed it. So that might be a way, if you are faced with somebody who is, you know, really needs those basic skills, to say, you know, we're really jazzed that you are applying for this, or, you know, we're excited that you're excited about environmental journalism, but maybe completing steps A, B, and C might be the way to start. The certificate programs are pretty robust and good, and we're updating them all the time. We're also more than willing to partner with other organizations to create custom certificates. So it's not a free option, but we have an ACES, American Copy Editors Society has worked with us to create an ACES certificate in editing. So ACES members get a discount on that certificate because the folks from ACES helped us develop the courses within it. So it's sort of a partnership that has worked out really well for their members as well as for Poynter. So we're always sort of looking for those opportunities. But I, as far as non-Poynter stuff, I definitely recommend a Journalist Resource.
Lisa, did you want to talk about that too? Are you still there?
I couldn't hear her just now. Was there something specific you wanted me to address?
Just about some of the beginning journalism classes that you guys offer at Knight Center.
Well, the Knight Center has mostly been offering the digital media type of classes in English and Spanish. They're not so much offering the beginning journalism classes. There are a lot of journalism schools, universities that are offering actual credit classes online, but that's a little different than the massive open online courses, which tend to be the professional development courses.
Okay, thanks. Tony, hold on.
Yeah, first of all, I'm Tony Davis, Arizona Daily Star, Tucson. I got here late, so I might have missed something that will answer my question or questions, but I'm a little curious to know where an environmental journalist who is in mid-career or whatever can learn more about how to effectively use social media for environmental coverage. And I don't know if there's any of that. I know you said, Lauren, that you have a social media thing, but is there anything that's geared in these journalism schools and environmental programs toward social media use? Secondly, I'm a little curious that as to exactly what is, when I read all these buzzwords on the web and job postings and articles and buzz and stuff about digital media, or digital journalism, rather. Digital journalism. What is digital journalism beyond simply taking your printed story and putting it on the web? What does it mean? I never see a definition. Those are my two questions. Thank you.
Okay. Who wants to tackle that first? Okay, go ahead.
From our standpoint, sure, why don't you pitch a project to come and spend 9 months learning how to do social media for environmental journalism? I mean, that's certainly something that we would accept and be very interested in supporting a fellowship proposal in. But there are a lot of interesting things going on. At CU, we have in our Atlas program, which we connect with through the journalism school, but it's an alliance of technology, learning, and science. It's heavily supported by Microsoft. And one of the professors in there has run a project called Project Epic, which we're starting to collaborate with. What Project Epic does is uses social media for disaster response. So basically, you can have people tweeting out a map of fires, where a fire is located, houses that are getting destroyed, earthquake hazards. You know, when during the Boulder floods, we were able to actually send out far more current information via Twitter and Google Maps and things like that. So we're starting to collaborate more and more with programs like that that are actually kind of driving development of social media for various causes. So that's something that, you know, would be, I think, interesting to a lot of environmental journalists. And there's a lot of social media classes at the university, if you, and I'm sure this is the case at lots of other university programs, where they're not geared towards environmental journalism, they're geared towards, you know, learning how to use social media. If you were to get into any number of different programs or workshops and connect with one of those classes, I'm sure you can drive that class to focus on environmental journalism or sustainability or whatever you're interested in applying it to.
Yeah, I'll pass this off in a second, but I wanted to answer your second question first, which is, what is digital journalism besides just putting a print story on the internet? Because I feel like my definition of digital journalism would be journalism that's created with its being digital in mind first. So you want to think about journalism that you create for the web, that's of the web, right? So there's all kinds of tools out there that will help you tell stories in an interactive way, in a shareable way, in a visually attractive, pleasing, fun way that serves the story really well online. So there's no reason at this point in history to create a story for print and then just throw it on the web. You do your story a disservice when you do that. And people read print stories on the web, but that's not the best way to use the web. There are so many tools out there. I don't know why, we don't think more digital first, because we can tell our stories so many different ways. So that's my definition of digital journalism, where you think first about how it will be presented on the web, how people will interact with it, how they will share it. As far as learning to use social media for environmental journalism, Poynter doesn't have a specific course on social media for environmental journalism, but a lot of our webinars address that topic. A lot of our courses address how to use social media for journalism. I think Instagram would be a great thing to learn about, right? How do you use Instagram for environmental journalism? There's a tool called If This Then That. Does anyone use that? It's a really cool free online tool. It's IFTT or whatever. And you can set up all of these contingencies, like a mousetrap. If this happens, then this happens, right? So if someone posts on Instagram about with the hashtag
of the river that you're interested in, right? Then you can store that image in, you can have it sent to some database that you can mine later. So there's all kinds of ways to set up different social media catchers online, different tools to use for journalism, and that would apply just like to environmental journalists as they would apply to other journalists.
Let me add something. So one thing that we've done at CU, and there are, you know, speaking of that, I don't know if anybody's seen, I think it was called C-Click-Fix, which is fabulous. And so that was, you know, really interesting example of using digital tools. I think one thing to think about it is we just have a really big toolbox now. You know, what is the best tool to have the impact that you want to have with a story? In this case, it was simply a way for citizens to use their smartphone to photograph something that should get fixed in a city. So you've got a bad pothole, there's a line down, and it would immediately send it to local press and to City Hall, and then create a method for the local press to follow up, hey, did this ever get fixed? So, you know, there's a really clever, you know, mobile digital way of doing journalism. We have taken my reporting on the environment class and collaborated with a transmedia storytelling class. And I'm happy to talk about transmedia with folks outside of here because it's fairly complex. But basically, it's multimedia, multiple channels. So it can be everything from a print story and radio and traditional things that you think of to a student who actually did interviews with firefighters, were focused on the wildfire crisis, and then turned those into a stage play where people read the scripts of the people that she had interviewed, which was a way to get this story out to a different audience. The toy industry, Hollywood, they all do a lot of transmedia. So it's got digital components, but it's also got traditional components that move together. And so there's a lot of really creative things you can do with that. And we had a social media team in our class, you know, three people who worked with Instagram, Twitter, and all these various other social media components so that it can promote our stories and send them out. But you can also tell a story in a digital way. One of the most fun ways, that I remember of that happening was Dan Baum. I don't know if anybody knows Dan, but he was a New Yorker writer and wrote a book called Nine Lives about New Orleans post-Katrina. And he lost his job at the New Yorker for, you know, variety of ways that writers lose their jobs. And he told that story of getting his job at the New Yorker and then losing his job in the New Yorker as a basically like a Twitter novel, where so it's basically 140 characters at a time, but there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them following him through this narrative, which, you know, there's a very, you know, just interesting form of digital journalism that I think, you know, a lot more people followed that kind of inside baseball thing through his Twitter feed than were interested in reading a story about it.
Yeah. So we've in the last year or so have added a component to our institutes in addition to all the environment and natural resource topics we cover. A guy named Mike Scott, he was an environment reporter at the Cleveland Plain Dealer and then became their online editor. So he's kind of like this epic nexus of this stuff. And he's also Kiplinger trained. So for a couple sessions during our institutes, Mike will get into everything from mining Facebook for sources. Facebook is a very scary place, if you didn't know. To, you know, how to tweet better, how to use Videolicious, which sounds really lame, but is actually a really cool program, and free. And so, yeah, we've added that, and the other one that is big is the document cloud. I mean, there's like this really amazing tool out there. So, yeah, we've added that.
Okay. So I'm going to take that question in completely opposite direction. One of the things that we've been thinking about in the mentor program is the value of actually getting together and being in the same geographic place with your mentor program partner. In response to the previous question about, I think I mentioned geographic proximity and how we've gotten away from it a little bit, but at this conference, we have brought together, I think, 12 partner pairs. One of them in India, from all over the country. We had funding through the Alyssa Rosen fellowship. Alyssa Rosen worked for the Pew and was killed tragically in a scuba diving accident. Her friends and co-workers put together a fund to enhance the mentor program, and we used that to bring these partner pairs to this conference. And I think the reaction to actually sitting down together and hanging out together a little bit has been pretty amazing. And so as much as we value social media and the virtual world of relating, we also are conscious of the value of just being together. One of our fellows just left the room, Bill Funk, and he is here as a result of the Alyssa Rosen Fellowship, and I forgot to mention that previously.
Lisa, are you still there?
Yes.
Did you want to address that issue, social media training?
Well, the MOOC I taught last summer, co-taught with the group, we went through what we call data-driven journalism. That's sort of the latest term sort of thrown out there. In social media, you know, increasingly is a big part of that. I think that the next frontier is going to be that everything that we can do on our other devices, be they video cameras or computers, are going to be what we'll be able to do with our iPhones or our cell phones. And we're going to be, reporters are going to be expected to do high-level data journalism, social media reporting, and also distribution all from our phones. There are already some people who are doing that. And again, the Knight Center is really a leader in that area at the University of Texas. They have an annual conference where they bring a symposium where they bring people from all over the world to discuss the latest in what's being done in journalism. And you can follow that conference online. Some of the archives are online. You don't have to go to Austin, although I recommend going to Austin. It's almost as fun as New Orleans. And then again, these MOOCs are another way to dip in and try to update your skills, be they on social journalism, searching tools, or any other aspect of what different people call different things. But like I said, one of the buzzwords is that data-driven journalism these days.
Okay, great. Thank you. And I want to say, too, that real quick, that you have to be brave because we're actually live streaming this today, which we've never done before, and somebody's watching online because I have one viewer for sure. So, go ahead.
You can watch it later, though.
I actually wanted to kind of partially answer a previous question about just sort of resources of training and stuff. There's something called the Association for Independence in Radio, which is obviously geared to public radio folks, who, freelancers mostly, and also to audio documentary people. But they have a great website that has a resources tab, which is you don't need to be an AIR member to access that. And it's got a laundry list of fellowships and grants, including some of the ones that are up here. I was just scrolling through the list to see if they were there, and they are. So obviously it's broader than just environmental journalism, but that can be a real great resource.
And I am a member of AIR, and I have, they sent me some bling. If you want some bling for your tag, I have some AIR bling.
Hi, my name is Rosalia, and I'm a reporter, an editor for environment at Kenya Broadcasting Corporation. Sometimes I feel like the threshold, you know, for selecting the fellows is a bit high. And sometimes, okay, fine, let me speak from my own experience. I have ever applied been shortlisted twice for one of the Knight Fellowships, and I didn't get to know why really they did not take me twice, even after being in the group of the last 12 finalists. So I'm thinking, is there a way that you can tell you finalists, I mean, this is why you did not make it, you know, to the list of 12, even after that rigorous shortlisting and the rigorous application process. Thank you.
So you'd like for people who are actually putting these fellowships out to not just leave you in the dark when and not get an email, kind of send it back and say, you know, if you knew a little bit more about XYZ, we would take you. Is that what you're looking for? Do you want to talk about that, Beth? Or no? Okay. All right. Anybody want to talk about that?
So not with Knight, so I can't speak for them. And one thing about the Scripps Fellowship, it's not our choice; it's our funder's choice. But it is only available to American citizens. That's their investment. They really want to improve the environmental coverage in the United States. I would love to have international fellows, and we do have other opportunities for people that are internationally associated to come and do things. From my standpoint, when we look for somebody for a 9-month fellowship, here are some of the things in a very broad sense that I've seen that I think handicap people and sometimes really incredibly good candidates who I would be really, I just thought would ace everything and then didn't do that well. One thing is that lots of people, they kind of put on an academic hat when they apply for a journalism fellowship like we have, and they don't really put their reportorial skills to use. So it's always really surprising to me when somebody applies for a fellowship with us and then has not looked into what we offer. And so they're asking for something that we can't deliver to them. We really want to have people that are going to come and be successful. And if we don't have a professor or some type of resource to really help them do the work that they want to do, then that's generally a drawback. And I can speak to that from my own experience. I got my fellowship on the second time that I applied. There were probably, I think, 10 years in between my two applications. And I got a very nice letter back saying, we really loved your proposal, idea, but we don't have the resources to help you do that. So, looking into making sure that they're going to be able to help you do what you want to do is really critical. A lot of people don't look at the professors they want to study with. It's always really impressive when you apply for these things and you say, so-and-so is doing this kind of work, and I know they're going to be on campus that year. I'd really love to work with them. One thing that I think is critical when you're applying for these big things is call a bunch of the people that have had it in the past and ask them, hey, what do they look for? What was really successful for you? What does this institution have that would support me? So that you can look at what other people have done before you that has been successful, and look at what their proposal was and look what they created out of it, so that you have some things to emulate when you apply. So those are just a couple of kind of broad things that I think can help people out, and things that really surprise me when you get to the interview stage with somebody and they don't know any of the professors that are at your school, they don't know what resources you have available at that school. It's not just that we don't necessarily have what you need in that case, but it also kind of shows that, it's kind of a turnoff for the people that are making the decision, because it's like, you haven't really researched us. You haven't really looked into what we can do for you. You want, to feel that somebody's hitting the ground running. They're only going to have 9 months. It goes by really fast.
Jay gave me the cut it off, and I know you guys still have tons of questions. I have given you the faces and the names. Beth Daly has a program she'd love to talk to you about, too, that I've been a part of later on. But we've got to cut it short, so if you have any more questions or anything, feel free to find the guys. I hope you guys enjoyed it. I enjoyed having you.
I was here. Okay.